Welcome to another episode of the Oncology On The Go podcast. I'm your host, Roman Fabricator. For this episode of the Oncology On The Go podcast, I was joined by Dr. Ritu Salani of UCLA Health. We discussed the approval of dostarlimab in combination with carboplatin and paclitaxel in primary advanced or recurrent endometrial cancer. Specifically, efficacy and the safety profile of dostarlimab in this application, implementation of the combination therapy into clinical practice, and other developments in gynecologic cancers were discussed.
What does the FDA approval of dostarlimab in combination with carboplatin and paclitaxel in primary advanced or recurrent endometrial cancer mean for this population?
So the FDA approval of dostarlimab for advanced or recurrent endometrial cancer is really, really wonderful to see. We know since March of 2023, when the data was first presented, that the addition of dostarlimab with chemotherapy followed by maintenance dostarlimab had a really significant impact in patients in this setting, particularly in those with a DMMR tumor profile. And we're seeing significant impact on survival benefit without really adding a lot of toxicity. So it's really wonderful to see relatively short turnaround in having access to this drug pretty readily for our patients who meet this criteria.
That's good to hear. Supporting data for the approval in the indication came from the phase 3 RUBY trial. What is your impression of these findings?
You know, like I said, the DMMR population, which is the patients who have deficiency in their mismatch repair proteins, really had the most pronounced impact, both in PFS, and we're seeing that kind of trend off for prolonged periods of time, where we're maybe curing many of these patients. I think the PMMR data from the RUBY trial leaves a little bit more to be desired. Although we see a PFS benefit in clinical trend towards overall survival, it's not statistically significant. And I think it just reminds us that we need to do better for these patients. So there's still some opportunities to capitalize on maybe tumor profile or other biomarkers that may be more meaningful.
Okay, that actually touches upon my next question. I know that you mentioned the statistical insignificance. It might have been nominally significant, but what unmet need does this approval help to reduce?
Well, I'm not sure that it's an unmet need that it helps reduce. I think it improves the outcomes of patients in the frontline setting or in that first line chemotherapy setting. But I think it actually creates an unmet need. I think if we're using immunotherapy up front, that was something we were commonly using in the recurrent setting or second line beyond. And so I think the challenge that we now have is what is the role, if any, of checkpoint inhibitor therapy after checkpoint inhibitor therapy or different types of immunotherapy strategies. So I think it actually creates a little bit of a need that we are now identifying. It does have a benefit for patients, and so it definitely addresses a need that we had, but I think it actually creates an unmet need now.
That's a pretty interesting perspective, considering that it's addressing a need on one hand, but I suppose it's unveiling another unmet need subsequently. So that's a fascinating insight. How might you see this combination therapy being implemented into clinical practice?
Yeah, I think we're going to see a variety of practice, influences from this data. I think you'll see some people who are using it for everybody who kind of meets this criteria. The FDA approved it for stage 3 and stage 4, so primary or recurrent endometrial cancer. And so I think you'll see some people who use it for everything. You know, the thing that I think is interesting is a study really highlighted patients who had residual disease or patients who had measurable disease present when they were getting this therapy. And that really seems to be where it's the most probably significant impact. There are some data emerging about patients who have complete resection of disease, and maybe the role of immunotherapy is not quite as clear, although that's a little maybe ahead of its time or premature. So seeing more data on really the right selection of patients will be really important. There are other avenues of treatment for this patient population, particularly the PMMR population, where you might see some other therapies that may have equally a profound impact as immunotherapy. And maybe that will lend itself to leading immunotherapy for second line if needed. And so I think we just need to be thoughtful about how we approach using immunotherapy in the front line or as first line chemotherapy options for these patients to really kind of sequence therapy in the most optimal way to give the patients the best survival outcomes as well as the best quality of life.
Okay. Are there any toxicities associated with this combination therapy that stand out to you?
There's not anything that stands out. We've been using immunotherapy and chemotherapy for several years now in different disease sites. And I think we've all kind of found that there are always some nuances with it. And it's important to be able to recognize and manage toxicities readily. But there's no new safety signals that we're seeing, particularly in the endometrial cancer population. But monitoring for thyroid disease and adrenal insufficiency, and then having acuity for other less common toxicities, even things like, myocarditis or cardiac implications, pneumonitis, things of that sort are really important. But I think we will all kind of find that these therapies are pretty easy to implement and manage with appropriate monitoring.
That must be a good feeling to know that they're predictable in a sense, in terms of how they're managed, and that there isn't necessarily a big mystery affiliated with the safety profiles.
Yeah, I would probably define it maybe better as well characterized. I think there's
Okay.
a, now that it's been used across multiple disease sites, I think most of the side effects have been really well characterized, but you still have to have acuity to recognize them. And it's, I don't want to say that these therapies are without any side effects. I think it's just important to monitor them. We have kind of labs built in, patients have symptoms to monitor, and really kind of paying attention is really key.
Okay. And then beyond this approval, what other developments in gynecologic cancers and oncology have the potential to impact clinical practice?
So I think if you speak about gynecologic cancers, the conversation can be pretty robust because there's a lot of exciting developments. But since I'm gonna stick with endometrial cancer, since that's kind of been the focus, we have a target for a maintenance strategy, particularly for the pMMR p53 wild type called selinexor, which has had some really provocative early data. So it's being validated in a study right now. And I'm really excited for that because I think that might be a way to strategize which patients get immunotherapy up front and which patients may benefit from this alternative option. There's other new agents. So I was talking about that needs gap about, creating that second line gap in therapy. And I think there's really exciting things on the horizon, including TROP2, antibody drug conjugates, alpha folate receptor targets, antibody drug conjugates, which I think are really kind of helping to inform how patients may do in these later lines of therapy. We also have HER2 antibody drug conjugates, which have just recently shown some provocative or compelling data in small numbers that's being further evaluated. And we have ongoing trials looking at HER2 expression or amplification in combination with chemotherapy, so trastuzumab in combination with chemotherapy. And I think the thing that this really highlights is that the treatment is shifting from you have endometrial cancer too. You have this tumor profile and really kind of focusing on a personalized approach for patients, which may optimize outcomes and minimize toxicities from unnecessary or ineffective therapies.
Okay. Is there anything else in relation to the trial outcome or the approval or anything related that you'd like to highlight?
From my standpoint, just personally, I would just say that I think this data is really exciting. I think it's changed the landscape, but I don't think it's enough. I think we need to continue to evaluate why patients who are dMMR may not respond to immunotherapies or something about their tumor profile, their biology, and the patients who are pMMR who have profound or exceptional responses, understanding can we exploit the tumors further. I think it's also really important that the patients who don't respond, we look at those and figure out, what are better opportunities? How can we select the patients who are going to get the most benefit and get them the right treatment earlier on? But I don't think this is by any means the end of the story.
Okay, thank you for your time.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology on the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology on the Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at Cancer Network without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at Cancer Network.